in a way, you can say, well, this feeling of sorrow that I have that it's going to come to an end is really rather irrelevant, because let me look at the thing from the other direction. Supposing it never would come to an end. In other words, here is this alternation of joy and sorrow. And however happy I am today, I'm always going to feel miserable later on. And then maybe happy again, but then after that, miserable. And this is never, never going to stop. I just can't get rid of the damn thing. Well, that's pretty depressing, isn't it? I mean, when you think it through. So you say, well, let's make a compromise between these two possibilities. One is that this compromise is, in other words, that it will disappear altogether, but then it'll start again. Because when it starts again, it'll feel like it does now, which is that it never happened before. So you're always in the same place, just like you feel now. Let's supposing that the Hindus are right, that the universe lasts for 4,320,000 years, and then it vanishes, and then it starts and runs for another 4,320,000 years, and then it vanishes, and it does it again. And it does it, and does it, and does it, and does it, and there is no end to this. But fortunately, because of the forgettery, every 4,320,000 years, it doesn't become a totally insufferable bore. There is this blank space, this trough between the crests of the waves. You see? Now, the Hindus thought about that, and they got tired. And they thought about the possibility of moksha, liberation, or nirvana, from the everlasting cycle of appearing and disappearing. But then when they had thought that through, the Buddhists, for example, having really said, now we've got the trick. As the Buddha said after his enlightenment, now I've found you out, you who build the house. I'm going to take the house apart. The roof beam is brought down. Desire is the builder of the house. See, I've found you. Never again shall you build it. And the Buddhists thought that one over. They said, crazy, we found a way out of samsara, the wheel of birth and death. And somebody one day said, but isn't that rather selfish? You get yourself out. What about all the other people? Don't you have any feeling of compassion? Oh, yes, they said, of course. We forgot that, didn't we? Let's come back again and help all these people out. And then they got very sophisticated about it, and they said, look, if nirvana is released from birth and death, then they're opposed. And so nirvana and birth and death go together, and they will have to imply one another. So you're only really released if you see that, if you see that nirvana and birth and death are the same thing. Now I'm going to pull a fast one on you. So every time an incarnation occurs, it feels like this one. See, it might be quite different. We might be reincarnated in another universe as beings of an altogether different shape. See? Not at all like human beings. But because we were used to it, we would feel that that was the human shape. We would say, well, that's natural. Obviously, that's the way things are. So naturally, if you appeared in the form of a spider, you would look around at other spiders and say, well, yes, of course, this is natural shape to be in. This is the human shape. Something that is not us looks at us and thinks we look perfectly terrible. I mean, imagine how you look to a fish. Clumsy, cumbersome, stupid-looking thing. Because a fish is so elegant and graceful and can slide through the water so beautifully. The human beings can't even swim properly. So don't you see that in every world that comes into being or could come into being, it seems just like it seems now. And every species that you could belong to would seem like this one. It would have its up end of what is highly intelligent, and its low end of what is not so intelligent. You would be aware of superior forces and inferior forces. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the idea of mastering a situation unless there were situations you couldn't master. Now, we are not aware of species, of beings above us, unless you cultivate those forms of psychic awareness where you think you're in touch with angels or something of that sort. But the things that appear to be above us are great natural processes. Only we think they're rather stupid. Only very tough. Too strong for us. Earthquakes. The elements. Also some little ones. See, the virus is a very troublesome being. And this is where a human being really finds himself at his wit's end in dealing with molecular biology. So, you know, if the monsters don't get you, the minsters will. The insects, you see. But at any rate, whatever level you're on, it always appears to be the same one. Now, we, therefore, naturally, don't we feel we're in the middle. We feel, for example, with the telescope, that there is a world greater than us that is infinitely greater. We feel with the microscope there's a world below us that's infinitely smaller, and we seem to stand in the middle. Of course you seem to stand in the middle. Every creature stands in the middle, because if you stand on a boat in the middle of the ocean and you turn around through an angle of 360 degrees, you will see the same distance in every direction. That's because you see. And your sensitivity to sight or the intensity of light is the same in every direction. So you're in the middle. You're always in the middle. Where else would you be? In other words, anything that perceives anywhere is always in the middle. Anything that grows anywhere is always in the middle. It's betwixt and between. And the middle always has, therefore, extremes. It has extremes in space. As far west and as far east, as you can think. As far on and as far back. And there's always a beginning and there's always an end. Just as there's a left and a right. Or a top and a bottom. So, also, if you are aware of a state which you call is, or reality, or life, this implies another state called isn't, or illusion, or unreality, or nothingness, or death. There it is. You can't know one without the other. And so as to make life poignant, it's always going to come to an end. That is exactly, don't you see, what makes it lively. Liveliness is change, is motion. And motion is going like this, see, going to fall out and be gone. So, you see, you're always at the place where you always are. Only it keeps appearing to change. And you think, wowee. A little further on, we'll get that thing. I hope we don't go further down so that we lose what we already have. But that is built into every creature's situation, no matter how high, no matter how low. So, in this sense, all places are the same place. And the only time you ever notice any difference is in the moment of transition. When you go up a bit, you gain. When you go down a bit, you feel disappointed, gloomy, loss. You can go all the way down to death. Somehow, there seems to be a difficulty in getting all the way up. Death seems so final. Nothingness seems so very, very irrevocable and permanent. But then if it is, what about the nothingness that was before you started? So don't you see? What we've left out of our logic, and this is part of the game rule of the game that we are playing, the way we hoodwink ourselves is by attributing powerlessness to nothingness. We don't realize that is a complete logical fallacy. On the contrary, it takes nothing to have something. Because you wouldn't know what something was without nothing. You wouldn't know what the form is without the background space. You wouldn't be able to see anything unless there were nothing behind your eyes. Now imagine yourself with a spherical eye. You can see all around. But now what's in the middle? See? Even if I have all this behind me in view, suddenly I will find that there is something in the middle of it all. There's a hole in the middle of reality. Like now, there seems to be not so much a hole but a wall, but any animal which had eyes in the back of its head would have the sensation I'm describing. Now, you may say to me, well, all that's wishful thinking. Because when you're dead, see? Now, wait a minute. What's that state of consciousness that talks in that way? This is somebody saying something who wants to make a point. Now, what point does that sort of person want to make? Like, when you're dead, see? Why, that's one of the people who want to rule the world. It's to frighten you about death. Death is real, see? I mean, don't indulge in wishful thinking. All you people who dream of an afterlife and heavens and gods and mystical experiences and eternity, oh, you're just wishy-washy people. You don't face the facts. What facts? How can I face the fact of nothing, which is by definition not a fact? You see? All this is twaddle from whichever way you look at it. So if you really go the whole way and see how you feel at the prospect of vanishing forever, of all your efforts and all your achievements and all your attainments turning into dust and nothingness, what is the feeling? What happens to you? It's a curious thing that in the world's poetry, this is a very common theme. The earthly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers. And anon, like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two, is gone. All kinds of poetry emphasizes the theme of transience. And there's a kind of nostalgic beauty to it. A banquet hall deserted. After the revelry, all the guests have left and gone their ways. And the table with overturned glasses, crumpled napkins, breadcrumbs, and dirty knives and forks lies empty. And the laughter echoes only in one's mind. And then the echo goes. The memory, the traces are all gone. That's the end, you see. Do you see, in a way, how that is saying the most real state is the state of nothing? That's what it's going to all come to. With these physicists who think of the energy of the universe running down, dissipating in radiation, gradually, until there's nothing at all left. And for some reason or other, we're supposed to find this depressing. But if somebody is going to argue that the basic reality is nothingness, where does all this come from? obviously from nothingness. Once again, you get how it looks behind your eyes, see? So cheer up, you see. This is what is meant in Buddhist philosophy by saying we are all basically nothing. When the sixth patriarch says the essence of your mind, that's how it is behind your eyes, is intrinsically pure. The pure doesn't mean a non-dirty story state of mind, as it is apt to mean in the word Puritan. Pure means clear, void. So you know the story when the sixth patriarch was given his office as successor, because he was truly enlightened, there was a poetry contest. And the losing one wrote the idea that the mind, the consciousness, was like a mirror which had to be polished. And constantly one, I have to polish my mirror, I have to purify my mind, see? So that I'm detached and calm and clear-headed, you know, Buddha'd. But the one who won the contest said, there is no mirror. And the nature of the mind is intrinsically void. So where is there anywhere for dust to collect? See? So in this way, by seeing that nothingness is the fundamental reality, and you see it's your reality, then how can anything contaminate you? All the idea of your being scared and put out and worried and so on is just nothing. It's a dream. Because you're really nothing. But this is the most incredible nothing. And the sixth patriarch, likewise, went on to contrast emptiness of indifference, which is sort of blank emptiness. See? If you think of this nothingness as mere blankness, and you hold on to the idea of blankness, and kind of grisly in about it, you haven't understood it. He said nothingness is really like the nothingness of space, which contains the whole universe. All the sun, moon, and stars, and the mountains and rivers, and the good men and the bad men, and the animals and the insects, the whole bit, all are contained in void. So out of this void comes everything, and you are it. What else could you be? So what I'm showing you is that all this hocus-pocus about the fear of nothingness is that, truly speaking, nothingness is what we want to talk about when we talk about the spiritual. Only it's all been ignored. It's all been put down. And say, oh, nothingness. Bleh! Heaven preserve us from that. But that's where the secret lies. And obviously the secret always lies in the place you never think of looking for it. In mythology, this comes again and again. Okay, this is Christmas. Where is the Christ born? In a palace? No, where no one would think of looking. In pigsty. Although, I have a Japanese friend who once said to me, he said, you know, the real difference between Christianity and Buddhism is that Christ was the son of a carpenter and Buddha the son of a prince. I thought that was rather funny. Well, we don't know who the prince is without the carpenter, do we? Now, it's in that sense, really, that I could suggest to you that you meditate on nothingness. I know you can't think about it. But yet, when it becomes perfectly clear to you that that's what you are, and what you were before you were born, where can anybody stick a knife into you? Fundamentally, you see?